I want to thank the organizers of the workshop for the invitation. This was a suggestion from Scott that rather than clog the conference last week, which was wonderful, that Brooks and I talk instead today, and so we're in a more relaxed environment. So happy to do that. So I'm going to talk first, then you'll follow me, I guess. At some point, so this is work in collaboration with Fei Huang, who is a former student of mine, who's now at UC Irvine, Jeff Kost, who is a former student of mine, who most recently has been a postdoc at IBS in Korea, Shufang Su, my colleague in Arizona, and of course Brooks, who's sitting right here. And this work took many years, actually. It was sort of a back burner project that slowly got closer and closer to the front burner, and then it was full blaze for the past 6 months. And we're glad to finally have gotten it out. And so what we're talking about here is how to look at the archaeological record of what we see in the universe today at the surface and dig deeper and learn about cosmological imprints of possible non-minimal dark sectors. This is what it looks like outside my office window in Arizona, sort of. A little bit beyond the city limits, but this is really what it looks like 500 miles east of here. If you get on I-10 from LA and just go east, you'll hit Tucson, and there you are. So I don't have to tell you all why dark matter is interesting. You all know this. And I don't have to tell you how it fits into the grand scheme of everything and why this is a ripe area for study because of data and because it's important. I'll start here, though. We really don't know much about the dark sector, if you think about it. We don't know how it is populated or produced. We don't know whether it's thermal or non-thermal. We don't know whether it consists of one species or whether there are many different components. We don't know what the interactions might be, if any, between these components. We don't know what kind of phase transitions or possible other non-trivial dynamics might be involved in establishing the dark matter that we observe today. And these are important questions because dark matter is ultimately critical for many aspects of cosmological evolution. It drives cosmological expansion during many epochs, and in particular, it seeds structure formation. So this leads us to two very fundamental questions. What imprints might non-trivial dark sector dynamics leave in the present-day universe? And more importantly, to what extent can we decipher the archaeological record going backwards, exploiting information about the present-day universe in order to learn about or constrain the properties of the dark sector? Obviously, going backwards, we can't necessarily do it in a completely rigorous way, but there may be things that we can learn. And this talk here is aimed at exploring what can we learn and what can't we learn, what might be the boundaries of this endeavor. So in this talk, I'm going to concentrate on one aspect of the present-day universe, which is the matter-power spectrum, P of K. This tells us about how matter is distributed in the universe. It tells us essentially about structure formation. This is in principle observable. This is the thing we would see today. But this depends, in turn, on the dark matter phase space distribution. And this, in turn, is highly sensitive to the early dynamics that we'd like to constrain, which would give rise to a resulting phase-based distribution for the dark matter, which would then influence the dark matter power spectrum, P of K. Now, clearly, going forwards, as happened, we presume, in the cosmological timeline, if I know this, that points me to a unique F of P phase-based distribution, and that leads me to unique P of K, but the process is not invertible. But we'd like to ask, to what extent can we nevertheless find signatures or patterns in F of P and P of K, which might tell us about the early universe dynamics that produced the dark matter and set this in motion? What can we learn? And that's really the main question of the talk.
But P is a momentum.
P, this P, little p, is a momentum. And I'm about to tell you what F of P is. I have not yet introduced what F of P is or P of K. This was just the plan. I will introduce...
Dependence on coordinate as well, right? It could be...
That's right. Absolutely, it could be. And on the next slide, I'm going to answer that question. So what is F of P? It sits in the middle. It's obviously a very important thing, so let's discuss it. So we'll begin there. So once the dark matter is produced in the early universe, its properties can be described through its phase-based distribution. And as Arkady just pointed out, indeed, it in general depends on position, momentum, three vector, and time. But we will assume homogeneity and isotropy and reduce this, therefore, to just dependence on the magnitude of the momentum, a scalar, and time, F of P, comma T. Okay? And what do we mean by this? This is the quantity, it's a distribution. It's integral over D3P, overall momenta, gives us the number density. And there's some normalization, some number of degrees of freedom per unit P. Likewise, we can calculate the energy density by inserting an energy there, and the pressure by inserting this. Energy is, of course, defined in terms of P that way. From dividing these two, we can deduce the equation of state. All this comes from F. So F is really the central quantity that's needed for understanding the cosmological properties of the dark sector. For example, questions we'd want to know, is it cold, is it hot, is it thermal or maybe even non-thermal? All those questions come from knowing F of P. Now, it's important to understand how F of P evolves in time because we're looking at the cosmological evolution and ultimately the archaeology going backwards. So in an FRW universe, I'll just remind you that X, the physical distance scales, it gets redshifted. Because of this, P of T, this is growing, so P of T must shrink in the inverse way to preserve the Poisson bracket, if you will. And from this, we derive a very simple differential equation. The log of P, the differential, is the Hubble constant, or the Hubble parameter, H, A dot over A. This is very important. This tells me that D log DP, only that time evolution, only corresponds, because this is momentum independent, that tells me that time evolution corresponds to additive shifts in log P. That's it. And so that means, for example, that if I look at the physical number density, because I'm interested in very simple shifts in log P, I'll convert this from its normal expression to being expressed in units of log P, because that's going to be the useful way to do things in this talk. So that inserts a P cubed. And we're not even interested in the physical number density. It's much simpler to look at the co-moving number density, which means I multiply this by the scale factor. So this quantity is time independent if there's no creation or annihilation of, let's say, whatever we're talking about, dark matter here. So I inserted A cubed. That multiplies this by A cubed. This then becomes the central quantity. We're going to call this combination G. This is the thing that tells me about the co-moving number density. All right. Well, the co-moving number density, if there's no annihilation or creation of dark matter, this is a constant under time evolution. Likewise, log of P, the differential, because time evolution just corresponds to additive shifts, this, the differential, is also not rescaling. This is a constant. And that means that this quantity also should not rescale under time evolution. And what that means is that once the dark matter is produced and before it decays or does anything else, this distribution of dark matter, the space-based distribution, evolves in time, just simply the time changes and the momentum changes, but G stays the same. There's no overall rescaling. And what that means is that if we plotted G of P on a log P axis, the total area under the curve is just this fixed, co-moving particle number density. And under time evolution, all that happens, if we set it up with G of P, this combination, and log of P, is that this curve just slides towards smaller values of log P without any distortion, as if it's carried along some sort of conveyor belt. And the velocity of the conveyor belt is just the Hubble parameter. So this is a slowing conveyor belt. We're going to use this picture, this way of thinking in terms of conveyor belts. It turns out to be a very powerful way of thinking about complicated systems under time evolution. So this is going to be called the cosmological conveyor belt, and this is the idea. It's plotted on log P, and we are interested in G of P distributions. Okay, now, for a minimal dark sector, regardless of how you produce the dark matter, we expect that once G of P appears, it'll appear on the cosmological conveyor belt when the dark matter is produced, and then it simply redshifts towards smaller log P on the cosmological conveyor belt throughout time. But for a non-minimal dark sector, it's possible that the dark matter of production may be much more complicated, with different deposits onto this cosmological conveyor belt occurring at different moments during cosmological history. And when I say non-minimal dark sector, I really mean a dark sector containing an ensemble of particle species instead of a single dark matter component. And that means that the phenomenology of this dark sector is not determined by the properties of any individual constituent alone, but rather collectively across all components, the whole ensemble of states. Okay, so let's just understand what we mean by different deposits happening at different times. So let's imagine, here's my cosmological conveyor belt. Whoops. So I make a deposit at some time T1, and there it is. I'll call it F for some obscure reason. But that is my little packet that's been deposited. That's some dark matter that was produced. Maybe at a later time, T2, there were some additional deposits. Maybe at T2, there was a deposit here, which had this shape, and a deposit here, which had this shape. But meanwhile, of course, in the time it took to go from T1 to T2, this guy didn't remain stationary. This is happening onto a conveyor belt. So this F has moved over to become D. So at time two, we would now, T2, we now have what all the packets that are in red. And then if I go further at any subsequent time, everything just evolves, it continues to evolve along the cosmological conveyor belt. So what I have at the end is some multimodal distribution combination here, AB, and another guy, E. And that might be what I see. And that's the observable maybe today. Note, the final result is very non-trivial and can even be multimodal just because of a non-trivial history in the early universe. Okay, so clearly the final G of P is realized as an accumulation of all previous deposits that occurred at all previous times during cosmological history. Mathematically, I can write that if there's a profile of dark matter deposits, imagine always raining sand onto this conveyor belt. Maybe dark matter is being produced by some ongoing process through the universe. In general, this is always true. And so, depending on the shape of this function, this is the profile of the deposit rate. And then at any given time t, the whole history up to that moment is an integrated set of these deposits where, of course, at any p value here, we have to look backwards in time at the unredshifted value for p here. Now, if the deposits happen to occur in discrete bursts, then this rate is just a sum of at each time ti of each deposit, there will be a profile for that deposit, and then G of P is just the discrete sum of the corresponding deposits. Either way, the point is that G of P reflects a particular cosmological history. So the archaeological question would then be, to what extent can we use G of P to resurrect this history? Yes?
So fields have dark energy. Let's say minimum coupled to this dark matter. Can you
Okay, dark energy is way beyond what I'm talking about, but yeah, go on. What's the question?
Could it be fit in this context? Can you use the conveyor belt idea to also talk about maybe delta total, dark energy plus dark matter, or you wouldn't be able to?
I'd have to think about how dark energy is going to change. I mean, I'm talking here about a matter distribution. And I'm kind of in the co-moving frame. What I'm capturing here by the conveyor belt is the effect of the redshifting. So I suppose something similar could be done.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'm really focusing here on the dark matter and the power, and ultimately the matter power spectrum. Yeah.
But it looks like maybe I'm wrong that this additional to this, it's like a change in initial data, right? So because you still have the same conveyor belt, but you are changing the initial data when you put in this additional input. Is that wrong?
Well, the question you're asking is, how much can I resurrect or reconstruct the initial data given what I might measure today, right?
Right, but in this way, okay, in given time, you are okay.
By the way, I've made no special assertion here. I'm just summarizing back very standard ideas. So I hope we got, this is clear. So what I'm just saying that you can't necessarily resurrect the whole deposit history.
Yeah.
All you can measure is the sum, G of P. Assuming we can measure the dark matter phase space distribution, which itself is an issue.
Like initial data after the last input, that's it?
Oh, yeah, right. Because then once I know this, I just know how it evolved backwards until I start hitting the epoch where there were deposits.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the archaeological question is, to what extent can we use GFP, a measurement of GFP, supposing we can make one, in order to resurrect this history? And the answer, obviously, is we can only determine the values of the sums along a backward history. I'm going to call this an FRW light cone. It's like asking about causality, backward cones, but this is an FRW redshift space, but you get the idea.
But
so we're restricted to the sum.
Anyway, I mean, if it would be no deposit, we still do not know what were initial data. How we can differentiate, after deposit.
I'm trying to understand. I would like to understand things about the initial dynamics.
Yeah.
So to me, it would be very helpful if I understood the deposit profile, let's say. How did sand fall onto this conveyor belt, given, in the end, some final distribution? So I'm thinking that way. Okay, now this is not, so we can only determine the sums along the light cones, but on the other hand, this is a lot of information because I don't just have a number here, I have a number for every single value of P. So this is an infinitely many constrained system. Now, it's still way under constrained because I only know sums along backward FRW light cones, but on the other hand, if I know something about the deposit shapes, the deltas, I get more constraints. Okay, but this is just standard ideas here.
Is this how we can ask?
Yes, sure. Okay. Please stop for any questions. Yeah.
the speed of the conveyor belt is also determined by the stuff which is on it, right? But you fix it to the dark matter to the dark matter density, right? And assume that everything is non-relativistic.
Okay, so I'm assuming that this is not the dominant component of whatever's happening. So indeed, Hubble would, in general, have some feedback from how much stuff is on the conveyor belt. In some sense, the conveyor belt gets heavier. Maybe Hubble changes its rate. But otherwise, I'm just assuming that Hubble is going to slow down 1 over t in some way. Now, let me also say that there's no assumption I'm ever going to make on the rate of Hubble. So if I want to assume that this is the dominant component, that will just change how the rate moves. But I'm never going to assume that it's radiation dominated or matter dominated. And even if I had a feedback, that would just give me a nonlinear change in how the conveyor belt velocity moves. Yes, that's true. Yeah.
Another question is, F of p obviously has an obvious interpretation in terms of probability of finding a particle. Does mm-hmm. g of p also correspond to a PDF of some sort?
Well, it's the p cubed times that. It's the scale factor. So it is a probability.
It's high just,
no, just like f of p is the probability distribution in p space, in D3p space, which is three-dimensional p momentum space. This is the same thing. It's the probability distribution in log modulus of p space, one-dimensional. But otherwise, it's exactly the same idea. It's the distribution of the dark matter.
But let's say that dark matter is unstable. Does it influence your consideration?
Yes, of course. I was assuming everything here about the cosmological conveyor belt is after dark matter is produced, or how it's being produced. If things decay, then you can imagine a little hole in the conveyor belt and things drop out.
Yeah.
Okay, but we're not going to worry about that. I mean, we're going to talk a lot about decays, but we don't have to worry about it as far as the conveyor belt. I will talk about what happens when things decay on a conveyor belt. Okay? Good. Wow, lots of questions. It's wonderful.
Yes,
yeah.
About your comment that now we are considering subcomponent, do you mean that we are considering just a subcomponent of
the No. Let this be the dark matter, and all I'm saying is I'm agnostic as to what sets Hubble. I'm just saying there will be some Hubble parameter. The universe will be expanding in some way. I'm not going to care how it does it. And I'm just going to say there is a Hubble parameter. Whatever it happens to be at whatever moment, that sets the velocity of this conveyor belt.
And,
that's all.
Do you assume that the deposit at some moment is independent of the deposit which was generated before that?
I made no assumption.
Okay.
I just say if they land on the conveyor belt, then this is how they add up. I've not said anything original here. I've just drawn it as a conveyor belt. But it's important that we get the language right, so this is good. Any other questions? Okay, I'm just reminding you of basic things here at this stage. Okay, so we've already seen... Whoops. Now what happened? Assuming I can go back to full screen mode. There we go. Okay, so we've already seen that multimodality suggests that separate deposits did exist, did occur at different moments in cosmological history. But you can ask, is it natural that there be separate deposits happening at different times? What kinds of non-minimal dark sectors could give rise to such deposit patterns? What I'd like to talk about mostly in this talk is if our non-minimal dark sector contains an ensemble of states, different components, which have different masses and lifetimes and cosmological abundances, then intra-ensemble decays within this ensemble, decays from heavier to lighter dark sector components, will naturally give rise to exactly these kinds of patterns. So for example, let's consider a three-state system. Ground state, excited state, second excited state, with only the heaviest state initially populated. And for simplicity, we'll assume a single unimodal packet. Very simple. Could even be thermal. All right, let's consider what happens as I evolve in time. So at first, time evolves, and so it redshifts a little bit along its conveyor belt. But then, eventually, it will decay. Let's assume that there's a decay of the form 2 goes to 1 plus 0. So here's the 1 daughter, and here's the 0 daughter. Note the daughters have extra kinetic energy because they get something from the decay. That's the boost, that's the conversion of mass. So wherever they were, they wind up with higher p values than they did have here. That's why they're sketched to the right. They're also a little wider than the parent was because they are boosted. Their decays are boosted, and that boost widens things because they do have a non-trivial p momentum of decay here. So that widens the width. This is just standard decay kinematics. Okay, what happens next? Well, time evolves a little bit more. And that guy shifts to here, and that guy shifts to here, but then this guy decays. And all he can do, or she, is decay into the bottom ground, so I guess it's a daughter particle we're calling it, so it's going to be she, decays into the bottom here, and this decay produces two identical superposed daughter packets, so the packet is twice the area. Again, it's wider than the parent was, and at higher momentum than the parent. And then, from then on, things just redshift along the conveyor belt, and my final distribution is this. Note, this is a non-trivial superposition of packet deposits that came from two independent decay chains. One that went straight to the bottom, one that went through the middle and then to the bottom. And that interference between two different decay chains produced the multimodality, and so the multimodality carries an imprint of the fact that there was some complex decay dynamics going on in the early universe. We started with something very simple, one mode, and just by having it have decay chains, already we produced this. This kind of thing, therefore, is very generic. But yeah, question.
Do you still preserve this conservation of comoving number density?
Yes.
Because this depends on what is the mass of the final state. If they are light, they don't scale as matter anymore, you know?
Yes, okay, but I'm just assuming here that, yes, that's absolutely correct. It's the energy density which would be conserved here.
Okay.
That's true. Gary.
Inference in this case, or just a classical, you know, anything?
Everything here is classical. I haven't worried about any interference. I haven't taken into account any statistics, Pauli, or all of that will come in when I show you actual results. These are cartoons, meant just to convey the ideas of the conveyor belts and the decays. Yes.
So, but the picture depends whether the species are kinetically coupled or decoupled from the standard model path, right?
I am assuming in all these decays that everything goes within the ensemble. That's an assumption, and later at the end I will talk about what happens when maybe I don't satisfy that. But right now in this talk, everything is going to be within the dark sector because I'm just trying to explore the dynamics that can occur within a non-trivial dark sector. If things decay and also affect the visible sector, then you have other ways of learning about what happened in the dynamics as well. I'm kind of, if you will, taking the worst possible case. What if the dark sector doesn't interact with the visible sector at all? What can we learn about the dark sector purely unto itself from the matter power spectrum, for example? And that's sort of where we're heading.
Actually, let me address in one fell swoop, Yuko, what I think your comment was, and Haibo, what I think your comment was, and Joseph, what I think your comment is. We are right now assuming not only are they kinetically decoupled from the standard model, they are also kinetically decoupled from themselves. So
no self-interaction. Yes.
Dark sector where we are not imagining that these things, you were talking about the existing things having an influence on what's there, which I think is kind of related to this too. So we're assuming again that they just add because they are kinetically decoupled from each other. Their interactions are negligible.
We are doing the simplest thing.
And that's easy to arrange, by the way, still having, as we'll see with the K's, which are right size. And,
right.
You know,
later I will give you an example where all of this is true and happens naturally, where all the interactions you're talking about, let's say within each other, are suppressed naturally. So this can be realized in perfectly reasonable scenarios. Okay, moving on. But even the process of decay from a parent packet to a daughter packet is actually very non-trivial if you think about it. And you could ask, to what extent does the daughter packet contain generic information about the parent? If I see a daughter packet with some shape, how can I, and I assume that it came from a decay from a parent, what aspects of this can I learn? So let's study how a packet goes from parent to daughter. So up here, this is going to be the parent. Later we're going to be populating here, this is the daughter. And we'll start with something very simple. The first step is going to be to decompose the parent into separate momentum slices. Boom, 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 ABC. And we're going to study the decay of each slice independently. We're doing this because each slice has its own momentum, and it's going to matter what the momentum is. So let's concentrate on little momentum slice A. Well, each slice redshifts before it decays because it has some lifetime. So it redshifted along the cosmological conveyor belt until the time of decay. Now, I'm going to assume for this cartoon that everything decays promptly at its lifetime. I'm not going to take into account the exponential quantum nature of the decay, but I'm going to come back and add that in later. But right now, just to get the scenario fixed, we'll assume the instantaneous decay approximation. That was going to come on the next slide, but you're already anticipating it. I just said when it decays. So according to its proper time, and as measured in real time, there may be a time dilation effect. And I'm going to talk about that on the next slide, but that's correct. So time dilated is put in here, and then it decays. Plop. And now it makes a contribution to the daughter packet, which is going to form. And I'm sketching it like a brick. We don't know what the shape of it is, but it's going to be something there. And then while waiting for the others to come down and fill it up, it's a process, this will still, it's on the conveyor belt now, on the daughter conveyor belt, and it will go until sometime. Okay, so the decay of each parent slice produces a daughter contribution with the same area as the momentum slice. The width of it is determined by the momentum here at the time of decay, because that boost is what broadens it. And once the daughter contribution is produced, it begins to redshift until the contributions from the other parent slices arrive. Clear? Okay, let's go to the next one. The slices with higher momentum, now we'll look at B, have longer lifetimes due to time dilation. But this also gives it extra time for redshifting to smaller momenta. So, while this redshifted this much, this will redshift even more because it's time dilated. That brings this closer to this in momentum in log p space than these two were originally. This effect compresses the relative decay values. You might wonder if it could actually cross it. You can prove it never can. It would require Hubble to go in an unphysical way. So it can never cross, but it'll come very close. This is a relativistic effect. Larger p decay, because it's always at a larger momentum, it will be wider than this contribution, but it will have the same area as this. The area is increasing, so the total area is increasing, but it is wider. And then this will also redshift until the final time when all the others, while waiting for the others to arrive. Note, the total redshifting time here is greater than here because this arrived later. Okay, next. This continues for all parent slices with even higher momenta. C comes along, it gets closer even still, it then decays, it's wider. Of course, the area of the daughter contribution starts dropping again because the area under each momentum slice is now falling, but it's still going to be wider because the momentum at the time of decay is increasing still. And then this has even less time to redshift before we're concluded. And eventually, we're done. And the redshifted daughter contributions combine to produce a daughter packet. The leftward tilt, the fact that it's looking more like this, the leftward tilt, is the relativistic effect stemming from the fact that we had relativistic time dilation effects, which ultimately caused these things to come down at different times, and therefore the earliest top parts of the packet, the narrowest parts, redshifted longer than the bottom parts did. And so leftward tilt tells me already that my parent was relativistic. We note that in this entire process, vertical momentum slices of the parent packet have become horizontal building blocks of the daughter packet, and the maximum and minimum widths of the daughter packet tell me about the maximum and minimum momenta of the parent packet. So how wide at the base is the daughter packet tells me about the maximum momentum of the parent. How narrow or cuspy is the top? That tells me about the size of the minimum of the momentum of the parent packet. And the slope shapes carry all the information about the decay kinematics. Okay? All right, so through these sorts of analyses, you can learn a lot of things about the parent packet simply by studying the properties of the daughter packet. For example, we already saw one. If at the time of production the parent is relativistic, relativistic effect will give me an extra contribution leftward toward the total tilt of the daughter. There are other things that will also determine the tilt of the daughter, but relativistic effects will give a leftward contribution. This alone can be a very useful result because, for example, imagine we have a relativistic daughter packet which is narrow, meaning its width is much less than its mass as well as much less than its average momentum. Well, this could be either, kinematically thinking, just about decay processes, either this relativistic daughter could be the result of a relativistic parent experiencing a close to marginal decay, not much energy injected from the decay, or a non-relativistic parent with a lot of energy injected to make it relativistic, experiencing a far from marginal decay. In principle, it might not be possible to determine the difference between these two, to distinguish the difference, but the tilt of the daughter packet may help you to distinguish these two possibilities, because one, because the tilt tells me whether this is a relativistic or possibly non-relativistic parent. So this could be one clue in the toolbox, and we're generating toolbox tools for the toolbox. Yes?
So that is, I guess, you assumed a very simple initial shape. So if the initial shape is weird...
Oh, yes. That will affect everything. That is why I'm not saying that daughters from relativistic parents will be leftward tilted and the others will be rightward tilted. I don't know that. All I'm saying is that relativistic effects give me an extra tendency toward leftwardness.
Give you a trend which can be...
That's right. Notice the word contribution towards daughter tilt. Oh, God, you guys are sharp. All right, wonderful. Any other questions? Yes?
So it seems like another possible complication would be if there are multiple decay channels that...
Yes. We're coming to that.
The simplest thing is if the two-body decay always two daughter particles, then it's pretty determined. But if there are multiple...
Oh, you don't mean decay chain, you mean multiple daughters in one decay?
Yeah.
Okay, three-body decays.
Yes.
Okay, that is true too, and I'm going to make a statement now. I have to make it at some point in the talk, so I'm going to make it right now. I will be talking here about two-body decays with daughters that are identical or not, and generic multi-body decays where multi-body is restricted to order one daughters. Meaning number of daughters is order one, not 100. I don't want to introduce hierarchies. And generic means the masses of the daughters are not hierarchically different from each other. In other words, if I have more than two daughters, I'm going to have a Dalitz plot. And I just want to say that I'm interested in generic regions in the middle, not the extremes. You can always mess it up. But otherwise, this is quite powerful just to assume that.
But maybe it could be formulated that you're looking for the gap in distribution. It doesn't matter for which reason, right? Because the gap in distribution would be your signal.
That could be too. Yeah. We had enough to do just from this, as you'll see. Okay, but you're right, absolutely. Okay, we can even push this sort of thing further. Now, I've already made a cheat, which I mentioned. Really, decays are not happening promptly at the lifetime. Particle decay, as you know, is a continuous probabilistic process, the exponential survival rate. Thus, you can't really determine when a given parent momentum slice will decay. Even as the slice is redshifting along, it's dripping sand onto the lower conveyor belt in an exponential way all throughout the process. And therefore, we don't even know what the decay momentum of it will be, because it's having a different momentum as it drips, as it moves along. So to proceed further, we actually have to disentangle the particle decay kinematics from the cosmology in which it's embedded. So here was that picture again, and if you think about it, this middle step here was the decay kinematics. This determined the shapes of the deposits. No matter what we had, whenever it decayed, it produced a deposit. That was purely determined by kinematics. But the cosmology is in this step up here and this step down there. This is the cosmological expansion or redshifting. This determines how these deposits accumulate on the cosmological conveyor belt. So we can actually separate these two effects. So decay kinematics alone determines how the daughter deposits depend on the decay momentum of the parent and the marginality of the decay. It turns out that if I assume that the parent is either relativistic or non-relativistic or very relativistic, so rel with a sim means P is approximately M, rel with a double big means much highly relativistic. And if I tell you that the decay is either near absolute marginality or far from it or approximately in the middle, order one, and likewise for relative marginality, and I have to define these things, relative and absolute marginality just mean the momentum of the daughter in the rest frame of the parent compared with either the parent mass, that's absolute marginality, or the parent decay momentum, that's relative marginality. Absolute marginality, this is what you're always used to. Relative marginality is something we invented because it helps us to do tables like this and distinguish the different cases. But once you know what the cases are, this is what you can show about the daughter. The daughter will either be relativistic or not as measured by a central value. It'll have a width relative to its mass, and likewise the relative width relative to its expectation value of its momentum. And we've written it this way because you see that if I know the daughter deposits, if I know that I have this kind of relativistic daughter with that width here and that width there, then I can read backwards and I can tell you how much the parent was relativistic or not, and whether the decay was near absolute marginality and was it near independent piece of information, relative marginality. These results, as I said, are generic for two-body decays and more generally for decays with order one numbers of daughters whose masses are not hierarchically separated from each other. Already a wealth of information, but this is just kinematics of a two-body decay. What we really are interested in is the interplay between the decay process and the background cosmology. This is what determines how the deposits accumulate on the cosmological conveyor belt, as seen in the co-moving frame. Now you can study this as if you're riding along the co-moving frame. Depending on whether the parent is relativistic at decay and what the relative marginality of the decay is, in other words, whether these conditions are satisfied, this is the rest frame, this is the daughter momentum at the rest frame of the, in the rest frame of the parent, depending on which condition you have here and which condition you have here, there are different cases that correspond to the different table. In some cases, very simple cases, the deposits land, as seen in the co-moving frame riding along the conveyor belt, each brick, each deposit lands on top of each other throughout the decay process. It's perfectly aligned, even though I'm on the conveyor belt, each deposit just happens to hit right on top of the other one. That happens, you can show, in this situation when you have this condition and this condition, or this condition and this condition, this box and this box. In that case, whatever was the width that you knew from the particle kinematics, the cosmology does not change it. No broadening. The other cases, most of the others, have weak broadening. The deposits are additionally narrow, but then they land on top of each other, and then they transition to where they don't, and they start missing, and they land next to each other or to the side of each other a little bit, and that widens the whole daughter packet that results relative to what you had just from the decay kinematics. And then there's even cases where the deposits land purely side by side, bum, 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 and so the buildup of the daughter packet is strongly broadened. Therefore, if you combine these two effects, you now can learn still quite a bit of information about the daughter distributions. So I'm telling you here that if you know the relativistic nature of the daughter and the width in terms of it relative to the mass and the width relative to this average momentum, you can deduce in a cosmological decay process how relativistic was the parent and was the decay near or far marginality. So we can invert and go backwards, read this like a table, and reconstruct the decay momentum of the parent, that's this, and the marginality of the decay process directly from the shape of the daughter packet. In some cases, for example, D and H, the reconstruction is unique. I know exactly what I can tell you about the parent. In other cases, several different reconstructions exist. There are redundancies. And these results hold, I want to say, even for packets which are part of multimodal distributions, where different chains gave me different bumps, each bump will still have these properties. Okay. When we include all the decaying cosmological effects, our previous expectations regarding the tilt of the daughter packet are also robust. And you can quantify the tilt of the daughter packet by something called skewness. This is a standard statistical statistics property of a distribution. It's defined this way in a log P space. It's the third moment of the G of P distribution, if you want to be technical. It's called the skewness. And you can ask, if I have a skewless log Gaussian parent packet, just a little Gaussian, completely neutral, not tilted left or right, it's skewless, and it decays, what is the skewness of the resulting daughter packet? And it depends on the momentum of the parent at the time of production. And as the momentum of the parent increases, just take that same skewless parent packet and move it towards higher momentum and start the clock and look at the daughter, you will find that that daughter increasingly becomes less right shifted than it started. The skewness increases. And this effect can be significant because most traditional GFP distributions, in anyone's favorite theory, are severely right tilted. S is usually very negative for what you do. If you do thermal things, Fermi, Dirac, Bose-Einstein distributions, anything else practically, you're going to start with things that are very negative. So this increases it. So this provides another tool for reconstructing the properties of the parent. For example, in the previous cases, C and E had a redundancy. This would break the redundancy. Okay. We also found, I'm just going to tell you, other useful results. For example, we found universal functional forms for certain daughter packets. In certain cases, we found, for example, that depending on the value of the decay width over the Hubble, at the time when you start this decay process, there are universal functional forms which hold for all daughter packets in the limit that the parent is extremely non-relativistic. Likewise, there's another shape that comes out generically for all daughter packets emerging from two-body decays in the limit that the parent is extremely relativistic, while at the same time the daughter is extremely non-relativistic within the rest frame of the parent. If that happens, you will get a shape like this always. So these are nice other clues that can tell you about reconstructing. Now, previously I argued that multimodality of the final phase space distribution can arise from competition between the decay chains. You remember this figure where we started with this and just got something like this at the end. But in this discussion, we also assumed that the decays happens promptly, not continually, not as a continuous quantum mechanical exponential process. We also assumed that each momentum slice of the parent was created at the same time, so that this decayed to that, and then this decayed to that. But quantum mechanically, this is going to start populating, and even before it's finished populating already, it will start populating the next one. These are other effects. So if we fix these effects as well, does this wash out the multimodality, or does the multimodality also survive? So to verify this, you can perform a full numerical Boltzmann analysis, which is what we're doing graphically. And what you find, and here's an actual numerical result, full, all effects included, relativistic effects, cosmological redshifting. I start with some thermal parent. I just choose it to be here. This is a thermal distribution. Notice how very right-shifted it is, how right-tilted it is. And then I assume different decay widths, decay chains. So these are the results. Blue is a decay directly to the ground state, which is what happens for this choice of decay widths. Green and orange are decays to middle states, and then they, while being populated, decay to the ground state. This jade color here is the decay to the middle state, and then a decay later to the ground state. And the red is the only case with two competing decay chains. It's a sum of the two decay chains are the jade and the blue packets, jade and blue, and together they produce the red. And it's the sum of these two packets, you can actually see that graphically, and it's robust. And so you can get multimodality just straight like this. Okay, any questions? All right, that was the first connection, dark matter dynamics to F of P. The next question is to understand about F of P goes to P of K, the structure, the matter power spectrum for structure formation. And the claim here too is that these kinds of phase-based distributions, especially these very non-trivial ones, have non-trivial effects on structure formation in the early universe. And specifically, they introduce non-trivial deviations in the present-day matter power spectrum compared to what would have been expected for ordinary CDM, cold dark matter. And therefore, studying the connection between F of P and P of K provides a way of learning about dark matter from its gravitational interactions alone. And this, therefore, provides a way of learning about the dark sector, even if it turns out, the nightmare scenario, that the dark sector might have no direct connection to the Standard Model at all. This might become one of the few ways we can actually learn about the dark sector gravitationally. So let me just remind you of the basic point. Cold dark matter, of course, helps to seed and promote structure formation. But if the dark matter has a non-negligible velocity, it's not just cold, but it has some velocity, then this overabundance diffuses outward because of that velocity, leading to a suppression of structure relative to what occurs for CDM because it can smooth, this motion carries with it some of the things. It smooths out the structure that would have formed. So over a fixed time interval between then and the present day, a greater dark matter velocity or momentum means that there's a greater length scale, or equivalently a smaller wave number, over which the diffusion can occur. So a conservative estimate for K, what Ks are affected by dark matter of a given velocity or momentum? This is, again, standard. You just calculate kind of a horizon. You can call it a free streaming horizon if you wish. This is the velocity that you have, it's the mass over the energy, the momentum over the energy. And then over this time, and K will take to be order 1, 1 over the horizon, and that's it. More properly, taking into account the fact that this is in an expanding universe, we'll have something like this. So we're going to call this the free streaming horizon, if you will. It's just the value of the minimum k value at, for any p. Dark matter has momentum p. This is the minimum k that could be affected by the momentum, by that dark matter with that momentum p. And c here is just some 1-to-1 coefficient. So for any p, momentum slice in the packet has momentum p. This is the minimum k that could be affected in the matter power spectrum. Okay, once you know g of p, you would proceed to calculate the corresponding suppression fraction, the transfer function. This is p of k divided by what you would have gotten for cold dark matter. This is called the transfer function t squared. And so what you do, you put in the initial conditions, perturbations, inflaton, et cetera, all the initial things that come out of inflation, all the initial perturbations. You also feed in your dark matter with some distribution. You evolve everything forward using the evolution equations, the Einstein equations. There are codes for this. The one we always use is class. This is sort of the common one. And in the end, you get out a curve, which is the t squared, the transfer function, which is this ratio. Now, in general, this is a very complex process. That's why there exist codes for this numerically. In general, the connection between g of p and p of k is very non-trivial. But we'd like to understand this relationship with an eye towards developing some rough procedures towards inverting it. Now, our approach is completely not justified, but it works. We somehow just came into it by looking long enough at it. We begin by asking about considerable momentum slices through our dark matter packet. And we normally would relate each slice of momentum to a corresponding value of the free streaming k, the minimum k which could be affected by the momentum in that slice, by the dark matter with that momentum. Now, normally, as I said, this would be interpreted as defining the minimum value of k which could be affected by dark matter in that slice. But we're going to do something different. This is completely not derivable, maybe. But we're going to do this. We're going to take the defining relation for kfsh of p as defining a mapping between the p variable of g of p and the k variable of p of k. Now, we're motivated by the fact that both have the label k, but these are completely different, unrelated things. But we're going to do it. We're going to identify this minimum possible k value with the k variable itself, and therefore consider g of p as having a corresponding profile in k space by just treating it like a change of variables. This is not justified, but we're going to do it. Yes?
So, this key k of fsh,
yes,
that has the mass in it, right? So can you still do it if you have multiple daughter masses?
So at this moment, I don't care what went into the dark matter phase space distribution. I'm assuming it's one species. So there's a mass for the species for which that is the g. Okay. Otherwise, you would have multiple species and then different things would occur. So I'm just looking at one inversion. Yes.
Really, the important quantity here is v, the velocity.
That's so true. It's always p over m.
We're assuming one species, and that's why we're calling it p instead of p. But really,
right,
if you want had more than one species, you could do it. You could rig these up as functions of v.
Okay. In fact, it's right here. This k starts as v. We just wrote v as p over e and then wrote it in terms of momentum because that's how we're used to thinking. But yes, everything would have some velocity, and that's all we care about as far as free streaming is concerned.
I have one administrative question. Yanu, how long do we have this room?
3.
OK, so I need to point that out, I guess.
My talk is shorter than his talk.
OK.
RV. OK. Somebody else is coming in here?
I'm not sure, but you're
reserved for time. Okay. I wanted to be safe. I think we actually do have more
time. All right, well, we'll try. We'll go fast. Is that a warning to me or to all of them?
We're approaching 1 hour, so I'm sorry.
Okay, let's go quickly. All right, so I'm going to define this thing as a change of variable by identifying these two. No reason, I'm just defining it. Okay. It turns out that because I've just done a change of variable, this holds, that if g of p was the distribution in log p space, g twiddle of k is going to be a distribution in log k space. So, fine. But here's the point. Because this k profile lives in the same space as p of k, because I defined this k to be that k, I can plot these two together on the same axis. which is something you never really could do. And if I do that, then it makes sense to ask, can we discover or conjecture any relation between these two functions, this g twiddle of k and p of k? And I can ask because now I can plot them one under the other, one on top of the other, and look for relations. So now let's explore. So for example, here are some phase-based distributions. G of P in P space, log P space. I'm just going to change the abundance. How much stuff? I'm keeping everything else the same. Same width, same location, just change the abundance. And I ask, what happens in K space? Here are the corresponding G twiddles in K space. Okay, fine. And here are the corresponding transfer functions.
So you're assuming that the rest of the dark matter is just infinitely cold?
I am assuming that it is infinitely cold. You got it. All right, now, first of all, wiggles. From dark matter acoustic oscillations, these are the wiggles. This is dark matter acoustic oscillations. Disregard it. They're not relevant for what we are going to do. Most of the time, I will show you things that didn't have the wiggles. We learned how to get rid of wiggles thanks to Adrienne and her graduate student. The important point, though, is that if we have more abundance, we see that we get a stronger suppression at larger k. We all not only a stronger suppression, but we also have a steeper slope. Okay, suppression and slope, both increase.
When you say you get rid of the wiggles, that's...
We don't get rid of it. I'm going to show you cases where they didn't occur until much later, so I just didn't want to pollute the plots.
This is based on the...
Everything I'm doing is complete, rigorous class output.
No, I'm saying, but it's interaction between the dark matter and the radiation?
Yeah, these are the dark matter acoustic oscillations.
Okay.
Yeah. But all I'm saying is, disregard the wiggles, or even better, let me say, I will show you cases where class does not give any wiggles. Okay, so I'm not getting rid of them by fiat. I'm actually showing you cases where there weren't any, but it's not going to change anything. I'm just saying disregard wiggles. Okay, so now let's examine one peak. We'll hold the abundance fixed and the central momentum, but we'll vary the width. So all I'm doing now is changing the width. Now you might notice it seems like the center is changing. It's really not. Expectation value of P is being held fixed in all of these, but in log P space, given that we're changing the width, that means that log P appears to shift as well. So it's an optical thing, but really we're only varying now the width. Well, the corresponding G twiddles look like this. Those are dashed. And here are the corresponding output from class, the matter power spectrum, suppressions, the transfer functions. Note again, increasing width, the width is bigger for the purple, very narrow for the blue. We see that increasing the width makes the change in slope more gradual. For the blue and red, it was very sharply changing. For the purple, narrowly changing. For the green, intermediate. So increasing the width, we get a slower change in slope, which means we have a less of a suppression. Don't forget, this is on a log plot. So less of a suppression at large k. But interestingly, the slope at large k is always the same. There is a conserved thing here. What was kept constant? The total abundance. It was always fixed. This suggests a relationship between abundance and slope of the transfer function. This suggests that how much abundance you've accumulated is corresponding to the slope of the transfer function. So as we sweep from left to right in K-space, more accumulated abundance that we have passed in K-space, more that we've passed, means that we've accumulated a more and more increasingly steep slope. At large K, we have the same accumulated abundance at the end because we've passed through the same normalized curves, but different suppression. But we have the same slope. That tells us something profound. Abundance correlates not with the net suppression, but with its slope. Let's see if this is true. More complex G of P. Let's examine two peaks, twin peaks. Vary the relative abundances between them. 5, 95, 50, 50, 95, 5. Here they are in the different cases. The corresponding G twiddles are here. Note that when this is hot, these are the colder, this is the warmer, this becomes the warmer, this is still the colder, this is now the warmer. They switch because K is inverse to P. And you see more abundance, sharper change in slope. So as we sweep from left to right in K-space, within each peak here and here, the accumulated abundance increases, the slope increases or becomes more negative. B Between the peaks, we are not accumulating any abundance, and the slope is approximately a constant. These are approximately straight lines in between. So we still see the accumulated abundance goes like the slope. Well, let's formalize this quantitatively. At any value of k, the total accumulated abundance up to that point is the integral in log k space from minus infinity up to that log k. This is the g twiddle, the function we defined. So for any value of k, this is the fraction of the dark matter number density, which is effectively hot, or free streaming, relative to the corresponding value p, which was related to that k value through this relation that we defined. So it has a physical meaning. This is the hot fraction function. At any k, this tells me how much of the total abundance is hot for the k that corresponds to that p through that relation. And then our claim is that the slope of the transfer function at any k is directly related to f of k. So f of k, the hot fraction function, is related to some function of the slope, the logarithmic slope, the first derivative. And I don't yet know the function eta, but I claim there is a relation like this, which means if I take the derivative of both sides, the derivative of the hot fraction function is nothing but the distribution g twiddle. This is the phase space distribution, or its dual in k space as we defined it. And it depends on the first derivative and the second derivative of the transfer function, logarithmic derivatives. I could even go one step further. Because remember, we had this plot. These were different fractions of total abundance. And I have the measured slopes that come out. I can therefore fit the hot fraction function to these different slopes. And I find that the slope relates to the hot fraction function almost perfectly, to very high precision, with that very simple relation. What that means is that I know the eta function. And that means that I now have a final conjecture which takes a very non-trivial form. If I know the first and second derivatives of the transfer function, I can reproduce g twiddle. I'm almost done. And this would allow us to resurrect g twiddle of k from the transfer function directly. Complete inverse map. Now, this is phenomenological, this is approximate. How well does it do? There are some technical points, which I don't have time to discuss. And we can actually see how well we do in practice by having some real examples. I don't need to go through this, the slides will be uploaded. Let me just show each one so that the video camera can record it. And then you can watch it freeze frame as you wish. But the basic point is that I've set up a model with 9 or 10 different levels, and everything decays with different widths. And I have two parameters, R and S, which govern, depending on how the couplings go, different preferred decay chains all the way through this whole thing. And so different decay chains give me different decay rates in this model, and consequently different decay chains here. The deposits all land on the conveyor belt at the same time. Here, there are very complicated things. I can calculate the energy densities as they transfer down the tower. I can calculate the equations of state of each guy as they transfer down the tower. Here, in the end, are the final ground state dark matter phase space distributions. In some cases, they're monomodal because all the deposits onto the conveyor belt happened at the same time. Here, they are bimodal because, or even multimodal because they happened at different times, confirming the whole idea that we had about the decay chains. A variety of distributions emerges. I can ask, does the slope correlate with the f of k? Well, here is the corresponding k-space distributions, and on top of it, the matter power spectrum. As I sweep across, I color. The rainbow colors tell me the growth of the hot fraction function. It always starts at 0, which will be 0. And then as I integrate along, I'm increasing how much the hot fraction function is. That changes the color. And likewise, I'm plotting the transfer function in the same color as whatever's below it. And you see, when the colors are changing, the slopes are changing. When the colors are constant, it's pretty flat, just like we thought. This is the end, let me resurrect the dark matter phase space distribution from the transfer function. This was my conjecture. If I have this and this, if I have the transfer function, I can calculate first derivative, second derivative, reproduce g twiddle. Here it is. This is what I had before. The blue are exactly what I had before. They gave me the transfer functions in black. And so the blue outline is the original K-space dark matter distribution. The pink shaded is my reconstructed directly from the transfer function. It's not perfect, but I think it captures almost everything I could possibly want pretty well. So we can invert this too. So this tells me that archaeological reconstruction is surprisingly accurate for a variety of possible dark matter distribution shapes, thermal, non-thermal, unimodal, multimodal, gosh, whatever the heck you want. So I think we have a lot of tools now. This is a rather large paper. I invite you to read it, but we have a lot of tools for archaeology. And there are lots of things we could explore. The couplings to the standard model will introduce new complications. We could incorporate the observational bounds and constraints. Most importantly, we've been studying in this talk the linear power spectrum, but in order to extend this to even higher K, which would be where most of the exciting action is, we'd also like to know if things like this work in the nonlinear regime. This would not affect the first part of the talk, but the second part of the talk. We are working on that right now, and we're hopeful that that will happen. So thank you very much. I'm done.